Mr. President, you have an opening statement. Without objection, it'll be made part of the record, and you may proceed as you see fit. We welcome you here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee. We meet here today to review the facts and the circumstances that were the basis for my pardon of former President Nixon on September 8, 1974. I want very much to have those facts and those circumstances known. The American people want to know them, and members of Congress also want to know them. The two congressional resolutions of inquiry now before this subcommittee serve these purposes. That's why I have volunteered to appear before you this morning, and I welcome and thank you for this opportunity to speak to the questions raised by the resolutions. My appearance at this hearing of your distinguished subcommittee of the House Committee on Judiciary has been looked upon as an unusual historic event, one that has no firm precedent in the whole history of presidential relations with the Congress. Yet I am here not to make history, but to report history. The history you are interested in covers so recent a period that it is not well understood. If with your assistance I can make for better understanding of the pardon of former President Nixon, then we can help to achieve the purpose I had for granting the pardon when I did. The purpose was to change our national focus. I wanted to do all I could to shift our attentions from the pursuit of a fallen president to the pursuit of the urgent needs of a rising nation. Our nation is under the severest of challenges now to employ its full energy and efforts in the pursuit of a sound and growing economy at home and a stable and peaceful world around us. We would needlessly be diverted from meeting those challenges if we as a people were to remain sharply divided over whether to indict, bring to trial, and punish a former president who is already condemned to suffer long and deeply in the shame and disgrace brought upon the office that he held. Surely we are not a revengeful people. We have often demonstrated a readiness to feel compassion and to act out of mercy. As a people, we have a long record of forgiving even those who have been our country's most destructive foes. Yet to forgive is not to forget the lessons of evil, in whatever ways evil has operated against us. And certainly the pardon granted the former president will not cause us to forget the evils of the Watergate-type offenses or to forget the lessons we have learned that a government which deceives its supporters and treats its opponents as enemies must never, never be tolerated. The pardon power entrusted to the president under the Constitution of the United States has a long history and rests on precedents going back centuries before our Constitution was drafted and adopted. The power has been used sometimes as Alexander Hamilton saw its purposes, in seasons of insurrection, when a well-timed offer of pardon to the insurgents or rebels may restore the tranquility of the Commonwealth, and which, if served to pass unimproved, it may never be possible afterwards to recall. Other times it has been applied to one person as an act of grace, which exempts the individual on whom it was bestowed from the punishment the law inflicts for a crime he has committed. When a pardon is granted, it also represents the determination of the ultimate authority that the public welfare will be better served by inflicting less than what the judgment fixed. However, the Constitution does not limit the pardon power to cases of convicted offenders or even indicted offenders. Thus, I am firm in my conviction that as president, I did have the authority to proclaim a pardon for the former president when I did. Yet, I can also understand why people are moved to question my action. Some may still question my authority, but I find much of the disagreement turns on whether I should have acted when I did. Even then, many people have concluded, as I did, that the pardon was in the best interest of the country because it came at a time when it would best serve the purpose I have stated. I came to this hearing, Mr. Chairman, in the spirit of cooperation to respond to your inquiries. I do so with the understanding that the subjects to be covered are defined and limited by the questions as they appear in the resolution before you. But even then, we may not mutually agree on what information falls within the proper scope of inquiry by the Congress. I feel a responsibility, as you do, that each separate branch of our government must preserve a degree of confidentiality for its internal communications. Congress, for its part, has seen the wisdom of assuring that members be permitted to work under conditions of confidentiality. Indeed, earlier this year, the United States Senate passed a resolution which reads in part as follows. No evidence under the control and in the possession of the Senate of the United States can, by the mandate of process of the ordinary courts of justice, be taken from such control or possession, but by its permission. In the United States versus Nixon, the Supreme Court unanimously recognized a rightful sphere of confidentiality within the executive branch of the government, which the court determined could only be invaded for overriding reasons of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments to the Constitution. As I have stated before, Mr. Chairman, my own view is that the right of executive privilege is to be exercised with caution and with restraint. When I was a member of Congress, I did not hesitate to question the right of the executive branch to claim a privilege against supplying information to the Congress, even if I thought the claim of privilege was being abused. Yet I did then, and I do now, respect the right of executive privilege when it protects advice given to a president in the expectation that it will not be disclosed. Otherwise, Mr. Chairman, no president could any longer count on receiving free and frank views from the people designated to help him reach his official decisions. Also, it is certainly not my intention, or even within my authority, to detract on this occasion or in any other instance from the generally recognized rights of the president to preserve the confidentiality of internal discussions or communications whenever it is properly within his constitutional responsibility to do so. These rights are within the authority of any president while he is in office, and I believe may be exercised as well by a past president if the information sought pertains to his official functions when he was serving in office. I bring up, Mr. Chairman, these important points before going into the balance of my statement, so there can be no doubt that I remain mindful of the rights of confidentiality, which a president may and ought to exercise in appropriate circumstances. However, I do not regard my answers as I have prepared them for the purposes of this inquiry to be prejudicial to those rights in the present circumstances or to constitute a precedent for responding to congressional inquiries different in nature or scope or under different circumstances. Accordingly, Mr. Chairman, I shall proceed to explain as fully as I can in my present answers the facts and the circumstances covered by the present resolutions of inquiry. I shall start with an explanation of these events, which were the first to occur in the period covered by the inquiry before I became president. Then I will respond to the separate questions as they are numbered in House Resolution 1367 and as they specifically relate to the period after I became president. House Resolution 1367, before this subcommittee, asks for information about certain conversations that may have occurred over a period that includes when I was a member of Congress or the Vice President. In that entire period, no references or discussions on a possible pardon for then-President Nixon occurred until August 1 and 2, 1974. You will recall, Mr. Chairman, that since the beginning of the Watergate investigations, I had consistently made statements and speeches about President Nixon's innocence of either planning the break-in or of participating in the cover-up. I sincerely believe he was innocent. Even in the closing months before the president resigned, I made public statements that, in my opinion, the adverse revelations so far did not constitute an impeachable offense. I was coming under increasing criticism for such public statements, but I still believed them to be true based on the facts as I knew them. In the early morning of Thursday, August 1, 1974, I had a meeting in my vice presidential office with Alexander M. Haig, Jr., Chief of Staff for President Nixon. At this meeting, I was told in a general way about fears arising because of additional tape evidence scheduled for delivery to Judge Sirica on Monday, August 5, 1974. I was told that there could be evidence which, when disclosed to the House of Representatives, would likely tip the vote in favor of impeachment. However, I was given no indication that this development would lead to any change in President Nixon's plans to oppose the impeachment vote. Then, shortly after noon, General Haig requested another appointment as promptly as possible. He came to my office about 3:30 p.m. for a meeting that was to last for approximately 3/4 of an hour. Only then did I learn of the damaging nature of a conversation on June 23, 1972, in one of the tapes, which was due to go to Judge Sirica the following Monday. I describe this meeting, Mr. Chairman, because at one point it did include references to a possible pardon for Mr. Nixon, to which the third and fourth questions in House Resolution are directed. However, nearly the entire meeting covered other subjects, all dealing with the totally new situation resulting from the critical evidence on the tape of June 23, 1972. General Haig told me he had been told of the new and damaging evidence by lawyers on the White House staff who had firsthand knowledge of what was on the tape. The substance of this conversation was that the new disclosure would be devastating, even catastrophic, insofar as President Nixon was concerned. Based on what he had learned of the conversation on the tape, he wanted to know whether I was prepared to assume the presidency within a very short period of time, and whether I would be willing to make recommendations to the president as to what course he should now follow. I cannot really express adequately in words how shocked and how stunned I was by this unbelievable revelation. First was the sudden awareness that I was likely to become president under the most troubled circumstances. And secondly, the realization that these new revelations or disclosures ran completely counter to the position that I had taken for months, in that I believed the president was not guilty of any impeachable offense. General Haig, in his conversation at my office, went on to tell me of discussions in the White House among those who knew of this evidence. General Haig asked for my assessment of the whole situation. He wanted my thoughts about the timing of the resignation, if that decision were to be made, and about how to do it and accomplish an orderly change of the administration. We discussed what scheduling problems there might be and what the early organizational problems would be. General Haig outlined for me President Nixon's situation as he saw it, and the different views in the White House as to the courses of action that might be available and which were being advanced by various people around him on the White House staff. As I recall, there were different courses being considered. Number one, some suggested riding it out by letting the impeachment take its course through the House and the Senate trial, fighting all the way against the conviction. Two, others were urging resignation sooner or later. I was told some people backed the first course and other people a resignation, but not with the same views as to how and when it should take place. On the resignation issue, there were put forth a number of options which General Haig reviewed with me. As I recall his conversation, various possible options being considered included: one, the president temporarily step aside under the 25th Amendment. Number two, delaying the resignation until further along the impeachment process. Number three, trying first to settle for a censure vote as a means of avoiding either impeachment or a need to resign. Four, the question of whether the president could pardon himself. Five, pardoning various Watergate defendants, then himself, followed by resignation. A pardon to the president should he resign. The rush of events placed an urgency on what was to be done. It became even more critical in view of a prolonged impeachment trial, which was expected to last possibly 4 months or longer. The impact of the Senate trial on the country, the handling of possible international crises, the economic situation here at home, and the marked slowdown in the decision-making process within the federal government were all factors to be considered and were discussed. General Haig wanted my views on the various courses of action, as well as my attitude on the options of resignation. However, he indicated he was not advocating any of the options. I inquired as to what was the president's pardon power, and he answered that it was his understanding, from a White House lawyer, that a president did have the authority to grant a pardon even before any criminal action had been taken against an individual. But obviously, he was in no position to have any opinion on a matter of law. As I saw it at this point, the question clearly before me was, under the circumstances, what course of action should I recommend that would be in the best interest of the country? I told General Haig that I had to have some time to think. Further, that I wanted to talk to James St. Clair. I also said I wanted to talk to my wife before giving any response. I had consistently and firmly held the view previously that in no way whatsoever could I recommend, either publicly or privately, any step by the president that might cause a change in my status as vice president. As the person who would become president if a vacancy occurred for any reason in that office, a vice president, I believe, should endeavor not to do or say anything which might affect his president's tenure in office. Therefore, I certainly was not even ready under these new circumstances to make any recommendations about resignation without having adequate time to consider further what I should properly do. Shortly after 8 o'clock the next morning, James St. Clair came to my office. Although he did not spell out in detail the new evidence, there was no question in my mind that he considered these revelations to be so damaging that impeachment in the House was a certainty and conviction in the Senate a high probability. When I asked Mr. St. Clair if he knew of any other new and damaging evidence beside that on the June 23, 1972 tape, he said no. When I pointed out to him the various options mentioned to me by General Haig, he told me he had not been the source of any opinion about presidential pardon power. After thought on the matter, I was determined not to make any recommendations to President Nixon on his resignation. I had not given any advice or recommendations in my conversations with his aides, but I also did not want anyone who might talk to the President to suggest that I had some intention to do so. For that reason, Mr. Chairman, I decided I should call General Haig the afternoon of August 2nd. I did make the call late that afternoon and told him I wanted him to understand that I had no intention of recommending what President Nixon should do about resigning or not resigning, and that nothing we had talked about the previous afternoon should be given any consideration in whatever decision the President might make. General Haig told me he was in full agreement with this position. My travel schedule called for me to make appearances in Mississippi and Louisiana over Saturday, Sunday, and part of Monday, August 3, 4, and 5. In the previous 8 months, I had repeatedly stated my opinion that the President would not be found guilty of any impeachable offense. Any change from my stated views, or even refusal to comment further, I feared, would lead in the press to conclusions that I now wanted to see the President resign to avoid an impeachment vote in the House and probable conviction in the Senate. For that reason, I remained firm in my answers to press questions during that trip and repeated my belief in the President's innocence of an impeachable offense. Not until I returned to Washington did I learn that President Nixon was to release the new evidence late on Monday, August 5, 1974. At about the same time, I was notified that the President had called a cabinet meeting for Tuesday morning, August 6, 1974. At that meeting in the cabinet room, I announced that I was making no recommendations to the President as to what he should do in light of the new evidence. I made no recommendations to him either at that meeting or at any time after that. In summary, Mr. Chairman, I assure you that there was never at any time any agreement whatsoever concerning a pardon to Mr. Nixon if he were to resign and I were to become president. House Resolution 1360.